From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. So far, it's been another hot summer through much of the U.S. Are the high temperatures related to the greenhouse effect? On this edition of Fresh Air, we ask Michael Oppenheimer, a scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund. He heads a project on developing solutions to global warming. Also, Douglas Gummery tells us how we went from downtown movie palaces to shopping mall multiplexes. Rock historian Ed Ward explains why the Burnett brothers never caught on like Elvis did. And book critic John Leonard reviews the memoirs of Andrei Sakharov. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet communists meeting for the eighth day of a national congress in Moscow overwhelmingly chose Mikhail Gorbachev to continue as their party leader. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Gorbachev's only challenger was a leader of last summer's coal mine strikes in Siberia. Six other communists were nominated for the job of general secretary, but withdrew their names before the secret ballot. Neither conservatives nor liberals offered a serious nominee in the race. Delegates said later there was little point. Everyone knew Gorbachev would be reelected, even though Congress delegates have pelted him with criticisms. Gorbachev took his own turn as critic today. He lashed out at conservatives who've been dominating the Congress and resisting proposals to make the party more democratic. The Soviet leader said many communists have failed to recognize that society has changed and that if the Communist Party does not adapt to those changes, it will be pushed to the political sidelines. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
A White House official says the summit leaders in Houston have agreed to conduct a study of the needs of the Soviet economy. The study is to be completed by the end of the year and will be coordinated by the International Monetary Fund. The U.S. and others have argued that this study needs to be done before the Allies commit financial aid to the Soviet Union. Otherwise, the aid may be wasted. The U.S. Senate began debate today on the major civil rights bill of the session. The Civil Rights Act of 1990 would overturn the basis of several Supreme Court decisions handed down in the last year that restrict the ability of employees to bring discrimination suits. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Debate on the bill opened with strong opposition from Republicans who charge that it will put an excessive burden on industry and lead to racial quotas. Supporters say the Civil Rights Act of 1990 seeks to plug up holes left by the recent Supreme Court decisions that make it difficult for victims of discrimination to secure justice in the courts. But Senate Republicans Orrin Hatch and Jesse Helms quickly attacked the bill as an underhanded attempt to force businesses to hire by numbers. Senator Helms.
This bill will not, as its advocates claim, simply overturn a few Supreme Court decisions from the 1989 term. It will destroy the principle that defendants are innocent until they're proved guilty.
But Senator Edward Kennedy argued there was no system of quotas prior to the recent Supreme Court decisions, and the new law shouldn't change that. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
Negotiations are underway to allow Italy to evacuate the thousands of Albanians who've taken refuge in embassies in Tirana, the Albanian capital. Italy's foreign ministry says the refugees would be taken from Albania to Italy by boat under the auspices of the United Nations. On Wall Street today, the Dow Industrials lost 23 points to close at 2809.84. Declines led advances by 2-1. This is NPR. The president of Kenya pledged today to continue a crackdown on dissidents as anti-government riots broke out across the country for the fourth straight day. President Daniel Arap Moi condemned the protesters as hooligans and drug addicts and said recent arrests of dissidents have been aimed at those who funded and encouraged violence. Unofficial reports say that at least 15 people have been killed in clashes between police and demonstrators. The fighting began on Saturday when 5,000 people gathered in a Nairobi square to demand a multi-party system. About 3,000 people gathered in Washington today for the funeral of homeless activist Mitch Snyder. Laura Kanoy of member station WAMU filed this report.
Homeless people, local politicians, activists, and Washingtonians who admired Snyder's tireless advocacy for the homeless gathered at Snyder's homeless shelter located a few blocks from the Capitol. The Reverend Jesse Jackson eulogized Snyder, saying although Mitch is gone, his work continues.
He leaves us here to tell the story. The story that America's dream is incomplete. The Liberty Bell has a crack in it until the homeless are housed and the hungry are fed.
Snyder hanged himself last week. His suicide note referred to a failed love relationship with fellow shelter worker Carol Fendley. But Snyder was also known to be depressed about the D.C. City Council's recent reversal of the district's right to shelter law. Snyder was the driving force behind the law 6 years ago. For National Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy in Washington.
Police in Colombia said today that they defused another massive bomb planted alongside a highway linking Bogota and the cocaine center of Medellin. The bomb, composed of 2,000 pounds of dynamite equipped to detonate by remote control, is similar to another one found next to the highway last week. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You've heard some of the gloomy predictions about global warming. Here's one. It's 50 years from now. You're in New York. There's been 30 90-degree days in a row. People are going nuts from the heat. The forests, or what's left of them, are going up in flames from heat and drought. And you can't even go to the beaches because they're covered with green slime. My guest Michael Oppenheimer is one of the scientists sounding the alarm. He's also recommending solutions. Oppenheimer is a senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, a national nonprofit environmental advocacy group. He directs their Global Atmosphere Program, focusing on solutions to the global warming problem. He suggests some of the changes we should be making in his new book, Dead Heat: The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. I asked Michael Oppenheimer if this summer's high temperatures are a result of the greenhouse effect.
I think we should take this heat wave as a good analogy for what the future will look like rather than trying to ascribe it specifically to any long-term global warming pattern. If we don't limit the so-called greenhouse gases, which over the long term will cause a warming of the earth, then we're going to see more and more summers like the brutal one that the western part of the United States is suffering through now, and the brutal one that the eastern part of the United States suffered through in 1988, where most of the East Coast cities, for instance, had about twice the number of 90-degree days. The farms in the Midwest experienced a brutal drought, and the barges were stuck on the muddy bottom of the Mississippi because there was so little water. Those are images which should remind us what the future will look like if we don't act soon to stop the growth of the greenhouse effect.
How certain are you as a scientist that the Earth really is heating up as a result of the greenhouse effect?
There are lots of unknowns, but there are a few things that we're certain of. And one of them is this: as long as we keep adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere, the Earth will warm. Not only that, the Earth is already warmer by about 1 degree Fahrenheit than it was a century ago, and a good deal of that warming is probably due to the growth in greenhouse gases.
What are your predictions for the 21st century if there aren't any changes in the amount of greenhouse gases that are released into the environment?
If we keep going with business as usual, with the emissions of these gases growing, then by early in the next century, Earth will be warmer than any time in the history of the human race, which is basically over 100,000 years. And that's 2 or 3 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than today. And then by the end of the next century, Earth will be about, anywhere between 4 and 9 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than today. And if that doesn't sound like a lot, remember that that brutal summer of 1988, where we had all those 90-degree days, was only on average 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal. So relatively small changes in temperature, in the mean temperature, can have very large effects on climate in general. So we'd be looking for radical changes in Earth's climate as the century develops. And these are things that are going to happen in my lifetime, hopefully, in your lifetime, in the lifetimes of our children, certainly.
Well, you have a scenario that you set out in your new book where droughts ravage American farmlands, the farmlands become ghost towns, there's food riots around the world bringing political repression, the population in America ends up moving north to Canada. Is that just to scare us? Are you serious about
that? Look, first of all, in smaller scale, all those things happen already. We do have food shortages in many parts of the world already. There are food riots. We have had severe drought in the Midwest. And in the 30s, of course, there was a Dust Bowl, and that did cause people to migrate. What we're looking at for the future, if we don't limit the greenhouse gases, is an intensification of those sorts of things which happen sporadically anyway. Populations will move as agricultural production moves from one region to another. Some regions will get dried out, and there is a good chance that the Midwest will be that sort of region, and therefore there'll be less farm productivity. Sea level will rise, and that will cause populations to shift from places like Bangladesh, the Nile Delta, even southern Louisiana. And where are those people going to go when populations move? There are conflicts. In fact, we're looking at a refugee problem which dwarfs anything we've seen so far from wars and the various depredations that humans sort of wreak on each other. So the future looks grim if we let the climate warming proceed in an unlimited fashion. But the important point to remember is this: it doesn't have to happen.
Michael Oppenheimer is my guest, and he's a senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, where he directs a program that focuses on solutions to the greenhouse problem. And he's written a book called Dead Heat, The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. Before we talk about some of the possible solutions that you've been thinking about, solutions to the greenhouse effect, let's just outline the problem a little bit. If you would just give us a basic reintroduction to the greenhouse effect.
Okay, here it is, quick and dirty.
Yeah.
You know what it feels like when you walk inside a greenhouse? It's warm. The reason it's warm is the glass lets the sunlight through, but it keeps the heat from escaping to the outside. Well, there are certain gases in the atmosphere, particularly carbon dioxide, which comes from burning coal, oil, and natural gas, and from cutting down forests and burning them. Those gases act the same way. They act like the glass of a greenhouse. They're transparent to sunlight, so the sunlight comes through and heats the Earth's surface, but they trap the heat as it tries to radiate back into space. As we build up those gases in the atmosphere, it is inevitable that Earth will get warmer.
You see the end of the Cold War as an opportunity for environmentalism.
And look, people are starting to realize that environmental problems are at the base of national security threats now. The big question for the future is not who'll conk who on the head, the U.S. or the Soviet Union. The big question is, are we going to destroy the ozone layer so that ultraviolet radiation causes a skin cancer epidemic? Are we going to change climate so radically and so rapidly that civilization can't adjust, can't keep up? Those are really the issues for the future that undermine our security. And I think all the nations of the world are turning in that direction. And as a result, I see this as a golden era for the environment in some sense. We have an opportunity to focus resources on that problem that previously went to doing things like building missiles.
Toward the end of June, Sam Nunn, the chair of the Senate Armed Services Committee, proposed shifting substantial Defense Department and intelligence resources to go to ecological problems. And he called for a new program that would retain extensive national security research apparatus at the Pentagon, but turn a lot of its focus into looking at the new national security threat posed by the degradation of the environment. Do you support that, and do you think it goes far enough?
I thought that was a fascinating proposal. Yeah. I'm two-thirds in favor of it. Senator Nunn got two things out of three right. Number one, environmental threats are security threats. Number two, we need to spend a lot more money on finding out about them. Mm-hmm. The thing that he got wrong is to spend that money in the Pentagon or in the Department of Energy. Those are bureaucracies which are not interested in the environment. If we're going to spend a lot more money on environmental research, we ought to set up a new setup. We ought to have what you might call a modern-day Manhattan Project, but not in the Defense Department. Instead of trying to do things to save the money inside the military, to keep the money inside the military, which is what Nunn's proposal is about, we ought to take it out of the military and move it elsewhere where it can do the real job that has to be done.
Last month, there was an international meeting in England that included environment ministers from 93 nations, and they agreed to phase out the production and the use of
chlorofluorocarbons.
Thank you.
CFCs.
Yes, and several other chlorine-based chemicals by the end of the century. What were your impressions of that conference? And I'm interested to know if you think that this is an example of a really new, positive international alliance around environmental issues, and if you think that this agreement will be effective in helping to stay the greenhouse effect.
The ozone depletion issue is related to the greenhouse issue in that the chemicals which deplete the ozone layer, chlorofluorocarbons, are also part of the greenhouse problem. They're secondary greenhouse gases. So if we control the chlorofluorocarbons for one purpose, it'll give us a side benefit in helping get the climate problem under control. And yeah, I think that the agreement is a good one. It could have had the whole thing happening a little quicker, but they're going to get rid of these chemicals by about the year 2000. So this is an agreement which, although it's not perfect, does point the way towards future attempts to protect the environment. And in particular, we're looking for a global climate agreement, including all the nations of the world, by about 1992. And we wish the United States would take some leadership there. The U.S., unfortunately, politically is falling behind on these issues.
Sounds great to get rid of CFCs, but, you know, I was just reading a New York Times article that covered the end of the conference, and it said, you know, that the price of phasing out CFCs may include greater electricity consumption, costlier and less reliable refrigeration and automotive products, and increasing public exposure to toxic substances and explosives. And suddenly things start to sound less good, you know.
Well, there are always trade-offs. Nothing is perfect.
Yeah.
But the loss of the ozone layer would mean a skin cancer epidemic of unprecedented proportions. It would have meant eventually skyrocketing death rates due to melanoma. And this is certainly intolerable. And what the agreement, which was originally signed in Montreal in 1987 and then just updated, what that agreement assures is that that industry will start the search for new chemicals that will not destroy the ozone layer, and eventually we're confident they'll be able to find chemicals and substitute processes which are not toxic as well. If we didn't start the process by restricting the ozone-depleting chemicals, we know one thing for sure, we would eventually cause a skin cancer epidemic. So that's one direction we certainly had to turn away from.
And we would have a skin cancer epidemic because the CFCs create a hole in the ozone layer which lets in ultraviolet light.
Right. The CFCs destroy ozone. Ozone is the shield that protects us from ultraviolet radiation. Ultraviolet radiation would have, from the sun, eventually would cause serious increases in skin cancer if the ozone layer disappeared.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about possible solutions to the greenhouse effect. And my guest is Michael Oppenheimer. He's a senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, where he directs a program that focuses on solutions to the greenhouse effect. He's written a book titled Dead Heat: The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Michael Oppenheimer is my guest, and we're talking about the greenhouse effect, which is the subject of his new book, Dead Heat. Okay, well, we left off talking about the need for chemicals that would replace CFCs. Do you think that there should be any government incentives to private industry to come up with alternatives to CFCs and alternatives to other dangerous chemicals?
I think government has to create conditions which discourage industry from creating dangerous chemicals. And for instance, it's not just a matter of creating, say, some toxic substance to replace CFCs. In fact, we can learn to change the very processes that industry uses, that we use, so that we don't need as much of these chemicals of any sort. And you can recycle, for instance, some of these chemicals in order not waste so many. A good example is the electronics industry, which uses a lot of CFCs as solvents. There's no reason that those CFCs should go up in the atmosphere after they're used. We could have nearly 100% recycling of the chemicals in that industry so that when they introduce substitutes which don't destroy the ozone layer, if they're toxic, well, if they're recycled, they don't get into the environment. So it's not just a matter of substituting one problem for another. It's eventually moving in a direction where you have fewer and fewer problems. And there the government has a very important role.
When you look at possible solutions to the greenhouse effect, how much of an emphasis do you put on lifestyle changes?
Well, I think the lifestyle issue is sort of a red herring. The way I look at it, over the next 30 or 40 years, with or without the greenhouse effect, even if there was nothing to worry about, our lifestyles would change radically anyway. If you look back to 1940, few people had cars. There were no computers. There were no lasers. So what I would like to argue is that 40 years from now, greenhouse effect or no greenhouse effect, our lifestyle would change radically anyway. The key thing, therefore, is just having a conscious public policy, as our lifestyle changes anyway, of just making sure it changes in a direction which brings us lower emissions of these greenhouse gases. And in this case, that means changing in the direction of lower energy use. And where we do use energy, it should be energy that doesn't come from fossil fuels. It should come from solar energy. We could, for example, satisfy all the needs of everyone on the face of the planet by extracting solar energy on just 1% of the desert land of the Earth. So technically, it's feasible to do without fossil fuels.
What are your priorities, both technically and in terms of lifestyle changes, for America to try to reverse the greenhouse problem?
People should first, on their own, look at the way they live and figure out how they could live just as well with just as good a lifestyle, only using less energy. And that means driving a much higher mileage car. The average new car gets 28 miles per gallon. You can get a 50-mile-per-gallon car, and there are prototypes which are just as comfortable as the average new car, the average of today's 28-mile-per-gallon car, but which get 100 miles per gallon. They're not on the market yet. If we had the demand, they would come on the market. Those cars emit one-quarter of the carbon dioxide that your average new car gets. There are light bulbs, highly efficient light bulbs, that last 10 times as long as a standard incandescent bulb, use a quarter of the energy, and over their lifetime, they'll save a half a ton of carbon dioxide emission per light bulb at the power plant end of the line where the electricity is produced that they use. Everyone should be going out and buying those light bulbs. Everyone should recycle more because the use of virgin materials actually costs us a lot in terms of energy. People should plant trees because trees are not only good in their own right, they cool off your house, and they remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. If your house is cooler, by the way, it means you use less air conditioning. Air conditioning, of course, uses electricity, which generates carbon dioxide. So there are lots of measures the individual can do. The government has a lot it can do, too. Government is a consumer. The federal government owns 500,000 vehicles. They should not get 28 miles per gallon. Those cars should get 50 or 60 miles per gallon at least. The government has lots of buildings. They should have the most efficient light bulbs in those buildings. The government can control the price of fossil fuels by doing things like taxing gasoline. So there are many things the government can do. There are many things individuals can do. The point is we should get off the dime instead of just talking about all these different options.
People really want American business to be competitive with other countries. What does competitive mean in terms of new technologies that are environmentally sound? And how do you think America is doing?
Just as the commercial jet plane was a spinoff of the military need for jets. And the commercial jet plane, by the way, sort of defines our whole civilization in a way. It's created this whole peripatetic culture, global markets for goods and so forth. There are defining technologies which are about to spring forth, hopefully, which will come from not military exigencies, but environmental exigencies. And I would point to solar photovoltaics, that is solar cells, as an example. Solar cells transform sunlight directly into electricity. They were invented in the United States, but the biggest share of the global market of manufacturing these things is now with Germany and Japan. West Germany just bought our biggest solar cell producer, Arco Solar. And if things continue as they are, we're going to wind up having to buy those technologies, the solar cells, from abroad when the world eventually does inevitably move to get rid of fossil fuels in order to deal with the climate problem. So I see great opportunity in these environmentally benign technologies. I think they are the wave of the future, much as, say, jet engines and computers were the wave of the 70s and 80s. And I think that our government should get on structuring some sort of policy which would keep American industry in the business of making these kinds of technologies.
Which countries are the leaders in creating new environmental technologies?
Well, the United States has been, but it looks like, as I said, the leadership is slowly sliding to Germany and Japan, as it is in many other things. And I look for the European bloc, the European community, led by West Germany, to be the leader in developing and selling new environmental technologies over the next 20 years or so. And I see Japan as very important in that regard also. And again, if the United States takes seriously the notion that it is a big world power, the way to be a big world power in the future, both politically and economically will be to invest in environmental technologies so that we can lead the world out of environmental problems and make money in the process.
Michael Oppenheimer is my guest, and he's a scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, where he directs a program that focuses on solutions to the greenhouse effect, and he's written a book called Dead Heat, The Race Against the Greenhouse Effect. You gave us something of a scenario before, like a worst-case scenario for the 21st century. If things were turned around, what would the scenario look like?
If we started today reducing our dependence on fossil fuels, getting rid of chlorofluorocarbons, ending deforestation, we could slow the growth of the gases in the atmosphere and eventually stabilize the situation. And I think there's a good chance it would be possible to do that with a climate that was only a couple of degrees Fahrenheit warmer than today. And that would be a noticeable, although modest, warming. It would probably not be disruptive. And it would mean a stable, economically viable, environmentally sound planet that we could pass on to our children. I think we can do that. I think we've got to try. If we don't start trying now, we have to remember this about climate problem. The effects are irreversible. The levels of the gases in the atmosphere stay there for hundreds of years, and the worst effects come decades after the emissions. So we're banking in trouble today that we won't really see the worst of until maybe we're gone and our children have to be there to deal with it.
You know, from what you say, it sounds like scientists really don't know for sure what the effects will be.
Scientists don't know in specific what the effects will be. For instance, I can't tell you, and no scientist can, what the climate of New York City or Philadelphia or Washington will be for July of 2036. But they can tell you that if we keep emitting gases this way, it'll be much warmer, sea level will be much higher, storm patterns will change, precipitation patterns will change, agriculture in certain areas will come under stress, that we're putting strains on civilizations which already have big enough problems. The climate problem is one they don't need. So, yeah, we can only predict the general outlines of what the future will look like, but those outlines are scary enough that we should want to stay away from them.
I think it's fair to say that the environmental movement has grown larger and more diverse than it's ever been. Could you give us your critique of what you see as the greatest strengths and weaknesses of the environmental movement today?
Well, the greatest strength is that it's a broad-based movement. Everyone's an environmentalist. World leaders from Gorbachev to Thatcher to even Bush want to proclaim themselves as environmentalists. And these issues are up in front of the public day in and day out. We've been very successful in getting them on the agenda. The greatest weakness of the environmental movement in the United States is that it is not, environment per se is not a political issue in the sense that other ones are. Since everyone's an environmentalist, so is every politician. Therefore, you rarely see politicians really forced to make decisions pro-environment or anti in a way that people can go into the voting booths and vote for or against. The public has been gulled, basically, on these issues, and part of it is their own fault. If you think about it, how many times do you go into the voting booth and pull a lever based on somebody's environmental record? Until people are willing to do that, you're going to see a lot of lip service and not much action. So I really look to Election Day, November 6th of 1990, as the next Earth Day. That's where people can prove that they really care about the environment by throwing out the rascals who don't care about it.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Michael Oppenheimer is senior scientist at the Environmental Defense Fund, where he directs their Global Atmosphere Program. His new book on global warming is titled Dead Heat. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Vincent Murano. For 15 years, he went undercover investigating the New York City Police Department for corruption. He found cops who were dealing drugs, committing robberies, and ordering murders. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Movie theaters used to be opulent palaces. Now we go to anonymous-looking, shoebox-sized multiplexes. Coming up, a history of the American movie theater with Douglas Gummery. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward plays us the music that should have made the Burnett Brothers rock and roll stars, but didn't. And book critic John Leonard reviews the memoirs of Soviet dissident Andrei Sakharov. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Violence continues in the capital of Nicaragua as pro- and anti-government groups and riot police clash in the streets. So far, since disturbances began Monday morning, at least 4 people have been killed and as many as 50 have been reported wounded. Robert Meyerowitz reports from Managua.
President Violeta Chamorro has told the former Sandinista army to bring order to Managua, but so far her orders seem to have gone unheeded. In a broadcast message last night, Chamorro said the army and the police would retake public institutions occupied by agitators. Striking pro-Sandinista workers have occupied several government ministries where the army is nowhere in evidence and the police are standing idly by in front of the buildings. Meanwhile, armed pro-government groups, angered by the failure of the police to act, have clashed with both riot police and with pro-Sandinista militants. Meanwhile, striking workers have shut the nation's land borders and international airport. Union leaders are demanding pay raises and that the government halt or slow its plans to turn some sectors of the economy over to private control. For National Public Radio, I'm Robert Meyerowitz in Managua.
A White House official says that leaders of the 7 industrialized countries meeting in Houston have agreed to conduct a study of the needs of the Soviet economy. The study is to be completed by the end of the year and will be coordinated by the International Monetary Fund. The U.S. and others have argued that this study needs to be done before the Allies commit financial aid to the Soviet Union. Otherwise, that aid might be wasted. 7 Cuban dissidents seeking political asylum have taken refuge in the embassy of Czechoslovakia in Havana. NPR's Alan Tomlinson, who has just returned from Cuba, filed this report.
5 dissidents climbed the fence of the Czech embassy yesterday and asked for help to leave Cuba to publicize their problems and the aims of their small movement. Before Cuban police arrived to seal off the building, 2 more people jumped the fence to join them. Several of the dissidents had only recently been released from prison after campaigning illegally for greater freedom of expression. They said they feared they would soon be rearrested as part of a continued crackdown on banned organizations. The dissidents probably chose the Czech embassy because Czech President Václav Havel called on Fidel Castro last month to free all Cubans unjustly detained. Castro responded with a bitter attack on Havel. Today, Cuba rejected a Czech offer to mediate for the dissidents, as the Czechs did in Albania, where thousands of people seeking freedom have occupied foreign embassies. Alan Tomlinson in Miami.
And the Northrop Corporation says that it plans to lay off about 1,400 workers at one of its plants in Southern California, building the B-2 stealth bomber. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 23 points to close at 2,890.84 on volume of 148 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a profile of a trio of musicians who enjoyed limited success in the late 50s, but who produced a few records that are considered classics. Here's the sound of the Burnett Brothers and their rock and roll trio.
Well, I don't need a doctor. I don't need a pill. Any other treatment, babe, would hardly make me ill. I need rock therapy. I need rock therapy. I need rock therapy. Oh, give it to me. Oh, give it to me. Oh, give it to me.
Elvis was lucky, people in Memphis used to say. If the cards had just been dealt slightly differently, the honor of leading the rock and roll revolution that swept across America in the mid-50s might have gone to the Burnett Brothers and their rock and roll trio. That's debatable, but looking over the story of this all-but-forgotten band, some parallels are inescapable. Johnny and Dorsey Burnett were from Memphis, of course, but in 1952 they were working for Crown Electric, just like Elvis, only as trained electricians, not as truck drivers. Their main guitar player, Paul Burleson, was a huge fan of black music, like Elvis. But unlike Elvis, he'd gone so far as to be part of bluesman Howlin' Wolf's band on the Wolf's radio show on KWEM. And, like Elvis, the rock and roll trio had cut some audition tapes at Sun Records, but they vanished. The trio was understandably upset at Elvis's rocket to stardom, so in 1955, they worked out a deal with the Electricians Union to get paying union work in New York. They got an appearance on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour and won three times in a row, which was all you could do. In May 1956, they were signed to Coral Records and recorded their first sides at a ballroom, the Pythian Temple, in New York.
Come on, little baby, let's tear that dance floor up. Come on, little baby, let's tear that dance floor up. Come on, little mama, let me see you strut your stuff.
Tear It Up, which today is considered a rockabilly song of the most classic proportions, was only a regional hit, but it was enough to get the trio a tour. And although they recorded with Dorsey's slap bass as the only rhythm instrument, on tour they added a drummer, Tony Austin, who was Carl Perkins' cousin. On one date on the tour, Paul Burleson bumped his amplifier while carrying it onto the stage. He dislodged a tube, and when he started to play, the strangest sound came out of his guitar. Burleson was smart enough to check and see what had caused this noise, so he was able to reproduce it when the band recorded The Train Kept A-Rollin' in 1956. It went on to become the band's biggest record, but once again, the cards fell poorly. 1956 was the richest year in rock and roll history, and dozens of classic records came out that year, so many that plenty of them never made the national charts, and The Train Kept A-Rollin' was among that unlucky number. Most people, in fact, never even heard it until the Yardbirds recorded it for their appearance in the film Blow Up. Naturally enough, Coral was getting impatient for the trio to have a hit, and they went to the unprecedented length of releasing an album by the group at the end of 1956. It was packed with great music, including another Train song. Of course, nobody was buying albums by rock and roll singers back then, and the Rock and Roll Trio's album became one of the rarest collector's items of the era. By the middle of 1957, the tension of making such great music and getting nowhere was beginning to show. Johnny Burnett was ready to compromise. Dorsey wasn't. In the middle of a show in Niagara Falls, New York, they got into a fist fight, and Dorsey took the next thing smoking to Memphis. Even though the band got a spot in the Alan Freed movie Rock, 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 it wasn't the same, and the trio disbanded. Back in Memphis, the brothers made peace and decided to move to L.A. to achieve success. With their wives and kids, 11 people in all, they rented a two-bedroom house in Compton, and Johnny bought a map of the stars' homes. He found his way to that famous house on Camino Palmero in Hollywood, where the Nelsons lived, and asked to see Ricky. And the rest, as they say, is history.
I've been waiting in school all day long, waiting on the bell to ring so I can go home. I throw my books on the table, pick up the telephone. Hello, baby, let's get some going. Heading down to the drugstore to get a soda pop, throw a nickel in the jukebox, then we start to rock. My school gal, baby, gonna taste some news. You should look good in the baby doll shoe. Well, it's a one, two, a four of a shoe. A three, four, get out on the floor. 5, 6, come get your kicks down the corner of Lincoln and a 46. Yeah!
After going on to write Believe What You Say for Ricky, the Burnett Brothers started recording as solo artists, Dorsey recording such deathless classics as Tall Oak Tree, and Johnny, You're 16, You're Beautiful, and You're Mine, which after all that glorious rockabilly, I just can't bring myself to play here. Johnny died in a boating accident in 1964. Dorsey records country music, and Paul Burleson lives in Mississippi and is worshipped as a guitar god by kids who weren't even born when he knocked that tube loose.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. On a recent Saturday night, I went to my neighborhood twin movie theater to see Total Recall. But the air conditioning was broken, so I went to a nearby multiplex. The sound was so low I could barely make out what was being said. And the popcorn was so stale, I didn't finish it. What happened to the fun of going to the movies? My guest Douglas Gummery has charted the history of the American movie theater and how we got from the movie palace of the 20s to the shopping mall multiplex of today. His essay on the subject is included in the new book, Seeing Through Movies. He told me what he doesn't like about multiplexes.
What I don't like is that it's too stripped down. It's just we don't have the multi-sensorous experience that we used to have with the movie palaces. And so at its best, you just get a movie in focus and the sound. At its worst, you get sticky floors and the sound not working too well, and the image often out of focus.
Well, how did movie theaters end up moving to shopping malls?
The movie industry reluctantly but slowly followed the crowd. So as people moved into the suburbs and built those houses and in the 1950s, first response was to have drive-ins. And we probably remember those, the large farmer's fields converted into what some people called passion pits, and they were popular in the 50s, but then as more and more stores were built, they first built theaters on the parking lots of shopping centers, and then as these gigantic malls that were self-enclosed and climate-controlled and their own worlds, really, started being built, which is the late 60s, early 70s, they started adding first one or two theaters kind of on the corner, and then the ones that are being built today all have 10, 12. There's one in Michigan that has 28.
Wow. What are the economics behind the multiplex where there's like 4, 6, 10, 12, 20 theaters?
It's to keep in the first place, it's to keep the cost down. You need one, two, maybe three projectionists at most, hence the problems with projections. You need one candy counter. Some of them are gigantic, several hundred feet long, serving 10, 12 auditoria. You need one or two ticket takers. The staffing is incredibly cheap relative to a single screen theater. And the other side is that you offer a diversity of choice. You can look up at that sign and see 10, 12 different films to choose from and pick the one that you like. So they went it from both sides, supply and demand.
Now, you talk about diversity. What always strikes me is that every multiplex has exactly the same movies.
Well, that strategy came later as as Hollywood discovered, and it was really one single film that did it. It was Jaws in the summer of 1975, 15 years ago. And they realized that with television advertising flooding the airwaves 2-3 days beforehand, and people, Siskel and Ebert, and et cetera, et cetera, that you made much more sense to release it to 2,000-3,000 screens at a time.
Let's go back in history and look at some of the earlier movie theaters. Movie theaters used to be movie palaces. Why was there so much invested in or ornate palatial architecture?
It was part of the package. One must remember that in the early days, the turn of the century, movies were considered downright unrespectable. The censorship boards attacked the film industry. It was considered a kind of low-life, evil, a kind of entertainment. I suppose the way I always describe it is it's sort of in the way of describing like professional wrestling today, is to say that I like professional wrestling. That kind of brands you as a particular kind of person. Same with movies. And the movie companies started to build what they considered so ornate, so vast, so wonderful an operation that nobody could dispute it. And they were right. Everybody fell in love with it by the 1930s.
Samuel Roxy Rothapel was the first movie palace king. What were his innovations?
He tried to add a kind of air of respectability to it. So he was very big into ushers, not just simply seating you, but there were people that would help take care of your children. There were people that would show you the way to these ornate, huge bathrooms. There would be special smoking rooms. They had staffs of, it seems remarkable today, of 100 ushers who were constantly on call trying to help you get into the right seat for the price that you paid when there were 4,000 different seats to choose from.
And the ushers had uniforms.
Oh, and they marched around. And he was in the Marine Corps, and he got the idea of changing the guard. And so every afternoon at 4 o'clock in his theater, whichever one he was operating at the time, there would be a changing of the guard a la Buckingham Palace, and people would come in the afternoon matinees just to see that.
You say that Balaban and Katz developed the formula that brought movie theaters to every main street in America. Who were they, and what were their innovations?
They were basically one family. Sam Katz was married to Ida Balaban, and her brothers and the parents and everybody was involved. Started with a couple Nickelodeons in the south side of Chicago and really developed what I think was a system. Rather than simply just impressing you, they developed a system which filled the theaters 12 hours a day, 365 days a year. It really made it into a business rather than a kind of hit and miss. They located them where people lived, all around the city, depending on the subway and elevated lines. They built these ornate palaces that really knocked the socks off people of the 20s. And they were the first, absolutely the first, to innovate air conditioning. They publicized it so much that they got doctors to write prescriptions for women in their third trimester of pregnancy, requiring them to go to the movies in the afternoon to get out of the heat. Because really, in Chicago in the 20s, where else could you go? You couldn't go anywhere else. That was the only place that was air-conditioned open to the public.
I learned from your research that movie theaters refused to sell candy until the Depression.
Right. Again, that was part of the image. Candy, and especially popcorn, was considered smelly and low-life and evil and associated with burlesque shows and associated with carnivals and hucksters. And they didn't want to have anything to do with that. That was the image they were trying to get away from. But once the Depression came and they saw people buying popcorn outside and candy outside, they decided they'd rather have the money than worry about their reputations.
In 1949, there was a decision that film studios couldn't own their own theaters. What effect did that have on the style of movie theaters?
Well, at that point, the theaters were pretty run down because of no repairs done in the Depression and no repairs during the war. And by separating them, it allowed the movie palaces to disintegrate. And so we started, sadly, in the late 50s, early 60s, tearing them down. In every major city, there were a row of them in downtown, which defined downtown. And in most cities now, there's only one or two left. And that really came about because there was no unity between Hollywood and the theaters to provide a device that Hollywood could reach Main Street. And also Main Street was moving out to the suburbs.
During the Reagan administration, the Paramount decree of 1949 that studios couldn't own theaters was dropped. So how has that changed the relationship between studios and theaters?
It signaled to the to both parties that they could join together and reform the system that had really defined the golden age of Hollywood. And so Columbia now today owns Lowe's Theater Chain, and Universal owns Cineplex Odeon, and et cetera, et cetera. And so in many ways, we're back to a system that Hollywood dictates. My favorite example, recent example, is a wonderful, delightful film called Field of Dreams, which is a baseball fantasy film. It came out a couple of years ago with Kevin Costner. And since Universal controlled the Cineplex theaters that was often shown in, they kept the film in the theaters for many, many weeks beyond what a normal chain would have done, and in a way built the film back to a kind of sleeper hit that it was.
So I guess this is good if you have a film that's distributed by one of the majors.
Right.
I think this is probably bad if you have a film that's independent.
Absolutely. It's the worst era for independent filmmakers since, 10, 12, 15 years ago. They really don't have very much power. You're seeing it in controversial decisions about X ratings and distribution problems. You'll see more of it until somehow that changes. Hollywood wants the theaters for its own. The theaters establish the big hits, and then Hollywood uses that to market pay TV, home video, and all the other ancillary markets. So they're not about to lose the grip on those theaters if they can help it. And the only thing I can foresee that will change that is a different decision by the presidential administration. The Bush administration has indicated no reason to change it, but you never know with future administrations.
One thing I have to say about the multiplexes, it seems that more of them are popping their own popcorn as opposed to getting in these huge trash bags of pre-popped.
That's part of
popcorn.
The Cineplex thing. They're also, you probably noticed, having more and different kinds of food and snacks to purchase. It's not simply just M&Ms and Good and Plenty's anymore. It's dozens of kinds of things that you can choose from.
Now, what led them in that direction?
There are many reasons. I think one of the most important and overlooked reason is that they're really trying to lure adults, and by adults, for the movie industry, I define people that are people over the age of 30, to films. In the 70s, it was assumed once you hit the age 30, you wouldn't go to movies anymore. You would watch them on television. The 80s have proved that's incorrect. There have been Driving Miss Daisy, a lot of interesting films aimed at an adult audience, trying to keep baby boomers and even older folks keep coming back to the theaters. And it seems to have worked. Despite home video, despite pay cable and all the other alternatives that we now have offered in our homes, millions and millions of people are still going to the movie theaters.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for, it's been interesting and fun.
Douglas Gummery is a professor in the Department of Communication Arts at the University of Maryland. His essay on the history of American movie theaters is included in the new book, Seeing Through Movies, published by Pantheon. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be hearing about the general strike in Nicaragua today. The Sandinista unions are locked in a test of wills with the government of President Violeta Chamorro, and it's not clear at this point how it's going to end up. Already there have been a few deaths in street violence that have developed from the strikes. Also, word from Moscow that President Mikhail Gorbachev still has his job as party secretary, and he has some words of warning to party conservatives who he says have to adjust to new realities. Also, news of the summit in Houston and a talk with the head of the American Farm Bureau about why we should work to end export farm subsidies abroad.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The memoirs of the late scientist and dissident Andrei Sakharov have just been published in the U.S. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
There's a great tradition of Russian autobiography. From troubled lives, Herzen, Kropotkin, Gorky, and Trotsky made world literature. The bad news is that Sakharov's memoirs don't belong to that tradition. The father of the Soviet hydrogen bomb and winner of the 1975 Nobel Prize for Peace is not especially introspective. His own marriages seem almost to embarrass him, though one gathers his first wife was difficult and her death something of a relief, whereas his second, to the remarkable Elena Bonner, sustained him through all miseries. Nor has he the literary gift to light up our understanding of the extraordinary men he knew and worked with personally, Khrushchev, Beria, Brezhnev, and Gorbachev. His many pages on hard science are heavy slogging for the general reader. I could follow most of the biology, but he lost me in particle physics, in matter and antimatter. I know this science explains both his privileged position in Soviet society and his passion for disarmament, but it's forbidding. The good news is that there ever was a Sakharov, and that we have any memoirs at all after the KGB stole 1,400 pages. From the raw material of his moral witness, we can imagine the hero. It never occurred to him to behave otherwise. Why? It's one thing for writers to be dissidents. Knowing our best and worst experiences happen inside the self, writers seek the language to express that self. When the state requires them, like the poet Mayakovsky, to crush underfoot the throat of my very own songs, we count on them to howl. From all those persecuted because of religion, we expect the same. But scientists can work in silence, anywhere, for anybody. An inner self needn't spoil the party in chemistry or physics. And yet Sakharov looked through his lens and saw, instead of particles or stars, a scruple. Written in blood on the space-time curve, a bill of human rights. Another trial to go to. Another petition to sign. Great-grandson of an Orthodox priest, grandson of a defense attorney, son of a mathematics professor, he grew up on Pushkin, Tolstoy, and Beethoven, Gogol and Dickens, Hamlet and Faust, Uncle Tom's Cabin, and The Last of the Mohicans. 3 times named a hero of socialist labor, and the youngest member ever of the Academy of Sciences, he threw it all away for Catholic nuns and Jewish refuseniks, school teachers, railroad workers, and garage mechanics. They were guilty of writing a letter, reading an article, seeking a visa, or belonging to watch groups that monitored Soviet observance of the Helsinki Accord on human rights. He named the prison camps and psychiatric hospitals where they'd been sent. He wouldn't shut up. There's a Miro poster of him on my wall. I used to think he was the sort of person Turgenev meant when he said, "An honorable man will end up not knowing where to live." But when Sakharov died last year, 80,000 children of the Arbat and the Gulag buried him by candlelight in a red and black coffin with a cut green bow to Chopin's funeral march and raised their fists in clenched farewell. And there's something more important than world literature, and that's world citizenship, for which these memoirs are a compass, a ticket, a user's manual, and a recipe.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He's a columnist for New York Newsday and media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed memoirs by Andrei Sakharov. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, ex-cop Vincent Morano tells us about his years in internal affairs, going undercover to bust other cops who had broken the law. Also, we meet musician and composer Marty Ehrlich, and Lord Schwartz reviews the reissued recordings of Toscanini. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.